This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, February 18, 2004. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. Howard Dean drops out of the race to be the Democratic nominee for president. As the crisis in Haiti worsens, we visit the gang-controlled port of Gonaïves. And we examine the mass arrests in Colombia that have become a tool of suppression for the Uribe government. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The International Committee of the Red Cross abandoned its generally neutral stance today and sharply criticized the Israeli barrier under construction in the West Bank, saying that it illegally expropriated Palestinian land and effectively cut thousands of Palestinians off from the rest of their community. From Gaza, Mohamed Galyini reports.
The statement on the Red Cross website added that the barrier violated international humanitarian law where it deviated from the internationally recognized border between the occupied West Bank and Israel, also known as the Green Line. The Israeli government says the barrier is being built as a security measure, but Palestinian and international organizations observing the impact of the wall say it deprives thousands of Palestinians from the agricultural land they subsist on, and it separates others from adequate access to basic services such as water, healthcare, and education. Also today, three U.S. envoys from the White House and the State Department arrived in Israel. They will meet with the Israeli Prime Minister to discuss the disengagement plan he put forward last December. The plan includes the evacuation of the Israeli settlements in the Gaza Strip, but Israeli officials have said that a similar withdrawal from West Bank settlements was out of the question. For Free Speech Radio News in Gaza, I'm Mohamed Ghalayini.
A recent Republican appointee to the Office of Special Counsel removed all references to sexual orientation from the agency's materials, including discrimination complaint forms, educational materials, and its website. Jenny Johnson is in Washington, D.C.
The Office of Special Counsel, or OSC, is an independent federal office set up to protect federal employees. Since 1973, it has been the position of the executive branch to prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation, and that is currently the position of many federal offices, including the Office of Personnel Management and the Justice Department. However, Scott J. Block, the new head of the agency, questions whether the government's anti-discrimination provisions apply to sexual preference. All information about the agency's role in prosecuting sexual orientation discrimination complaints have been removed from the public domain. Elaine Kaplan, former head of the OSC for 5 years, thinks this is a big mistake.
If that office comes to the conclusion that they don't think the law protects gay and lesbian employees against discrimination, then that's going to be a real problem because that office has a lot of sort of authority to decide whether to prosecute cases.
For Free Speech Radio News, I am Jenny Johnson.
A grand jury declined to indict a police officer in the fatal shooting of an unarmed teenager on a Brooklyn rooftop. From New York City, Amma Bouadi reports.
The decision not to charge Officer Richard Neri of criminal wrongdoing after he shot unarmed teenager Timothy Stansbury Jr. did not sit well with Stansbury's family or civil rights advocates like Steve Yip from the October 22nd Coalition.
We will see more killing. We will see more sophisticated responses to try to stifle outrage and to blunt people's responses so that people are confused, that the mechanism of public relations is already cranking, and we need to expose that and expose the hand of the district attorney in terms of their historical role in whitewashing.
Meanwhile, a police department spokesman said separate NYPD firearm discharge review boards will review the shooting and report their findings to Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly, who will determine whether Neri will be charged with violating police rules. For Free Speech Radio News in New York City, I'm Amma Bouadi.
Officials in the Kerala state of India say that a Coca-Cola manufacturing plant uses 400,000 gallons of well water daily, leaving local farmers with parched fields, and ordered them to stop. The Coca-Cola company today called the decision unwarranted and unjustifiable. Binu Alex reports from Ahmedabad.
There seems to be no respite for cola majors Coke and Pepsi. Early this month, a committee of Indian parliamentarians has confirmed that these drinks are pesticide-ridden.
It's time to grab a Pepsi.
And yesterday, South Indian state of Kerala banned Coca-Cola plant from drawing underground water. The government order said it was up to the company to decide whether it would tap other sources of water or close down the plant. The company called the decision unfortunate. Protests are still on by local villagers charging the company of depleting water levels and discharging sludge from its plant in nearby fields. The anti-cola activists say this is the day they have been waiting for. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Binu Alex in Ahmedabad, India.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
It's now official. Former Vermont Governor Howard Dean has dropped out of the race to become the Democratic presidential candidate.
I am no longer actively pursuing the presidency. We will, however, continue to build a new organization using our enormous grassroots network to continue the effort to transform the Democratic Party and to change our country.
Dean's decision comes one day after he polled third in the Wisconsin primary, which saw John Kerry pull way ahead in the number of delegates he has. William Grider, national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine, believes Dean was railroaded by the media because of his message.
And it came at the very time when the general public was just beginning to get engaged in the question of the Democratic contest. So it was extremely damaging. And worse than that, it blew away all of the substantive content of his campaign. He, for 6 weeks or longer, he did nothing but respond to attacks. And it had its effect. I think it greatly undercut his popularity, but also sowed doubts among people who were really just considering the different candidates.
An aide says Dean will be launching a campaign for change within the Democratic Party, even as he ends his presidential campaign. The aide says Dean wants to keep his issues alive and keep his supporters organized. Pacifica Radio's senior political analyst Larry Bensky believes that Dean's role in the 2004 campaign is not over yet.
People should remember that Howard Dean is a medical doctor and that one of the preoccupations of people who will be voting in the fall is the inadequacy and in the injustice of the healthcare system in this country. So if the Democrats wanted to send him out and he was willing to be sent out on the road talking about how the Democrats will change our inequitable and unjust health system, he could have a big role to play. There's also the fact that he has something like 300,000 donors in his database who gave him over $45 million. That's a resource the Democrats are going to want to exploit further, and they may well be able to do so if Dean comes on board.
At this stage, Dean has said that he is not endorsing either Kerry or Edwards. Following calls yesterday by the Dominican Republic for the international community to help the tiny Caribbean nation of Haiti, Canada and France today announced they will send policing troops to Haiti to back up the island's 4,000-member force. Meanwhile, hundreds of Haitian Red Cross volunteers have been mobilized to provide life-saving first aid, run ambulance service in the capital, Port-au-Prince, and distribute humanitarian goods to victims of the violence. And while the humanitarian crisis escalates, particular concern is being focused on Haiti's fourth-largest city of Gonaïves, which earlier this month was seized by armed anti-government gangs demanding the resignation of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Last Friday, the gang announced it had joined forces with former military and paramilitary leaders, an ominous sign for the besieged government. Reed Lindsay reports from Gonaïves.
Last Friday, rebel leader Boute Metier sat on a shabby couch in a dirt-floored shack, flanked by a dozen men wearing camouflage and holding a motley array of aged firearms. His message to Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was unequivocal: resign or else.
We are telling the national and international community that we are ready to give up our guns, but only if they take away Aristide at the same time. We are not a group of bandits that's going to stay in the country forever. We are just a group that wants Aristide to leave the country. As we liberated the Atibonite Valley, we'll do the same for Cap Haitien, and we're going to see how we can liberate Port-au-Prince.
Metier, a suspected drug trafficker whose armed gang had driven out police and taken control of Gonaïve on February 5th, was accompanied by two dark figures from Haiti's past. Louis-Jodel Chamblan, former co-leader of a now-defunct murderous paramilitary group known as FRAP, and Guy Philippe, a police chief wanted by the government for an alleged coup attempt. The appearance of Chamblain and Philippe in Gonaïves sounded alarm bells in Port-au-Prince, where government officials feared they could have the military capacity and the political ambition to extend the revolt nationwide. In recent weeks, some 50 people have been killed in Gonaïves and several other towns where the police have been driven out. The rebellion has fueled an escalating political crisis marked by the freezing of international aid since 2000 and the political opposition's refusal to participate in elections and in parliament. While opposition leaders insist they are independent from the rebels, they have expressed sympathy for them.
The people are in their right to request Mr. Aristide's resignation and start denying cooperation with Mr. Aristide. We prone a nonviolent approach.
Andy Appaid is a New York-born millionaire businessman who leads the opposition.
Mr. Aristide has armed people to terrorize the opposition and the society. Today, they turned against him.
The Port-au-Prince-based opposition groups have been gaining in force in the last 2 years, although analysts say they still have much less support than does Aristide, who was elected president with overwhelming margins in 1990 and 2000. On Sunday, the opposition held its first march since the takeover in Gonaïves. Despite the enthusiasm, the demonstration drew little more than 1,000 people, tiny compared with a massive pro-Aristide march held on February 7th. In Port-au-Prince, long a bastion of support for Aristide, many poor Haitians continued to back the government despite the worsening conflict and deteriorating economic conditions. A former priest who opened a home for street children, Aristide holds an almost mythic stature among the majority of Haitians who are black and poor. Last week, several hundred Aristide supporters forced the cancellation of an opposition march as they stood behind barricades of burning tires. They chanted 5 years, indicating the length of the term Aristide is serving. Opposition leaders say these people are armed and financed by the president. Aristide has denied this. Leslie Voltaire is Minister of Haitians Living Abroad and a former chief of staff under Aristide.
The people will arm themselves to keep him in power until he goes. And this is why the opposition cannot overthrow him.
But with no army, which was disbanded by Aristide in 1994, and a meager police force of 4,000 officers, questions remain about whether the government is capable of retaking Gonaïves. Earlier this week, the capital of the Central Plateau region of eastern Haiti was taken over by rebels. Yesterday, Haiti's prime minister called for help from the international community. French Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin said France would consider sending a peacekeeping force, while U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell said the United States had no enthusiasm for a military intervention. From Port-au-Prince and Gonaïves, I'm Reed Lindsay for Free Speech Radio News.
The Republican and Democratic leaders of the House Committee on Government Reform are calling on the Department of Agriculture to reopen its probe into the mad cow disease. In a letter to the department's Secretary Ann Veneman, the committee leaders said that three witnesses have testified that the Washington cow that had the disease was able to stand and walk, contradicting previous claims that the animal was a downer cow. Mitch Jeserich has more from Washington, D.C.
Three witnesses are now saying that the mad cow discovered in Washington last December was able to walk. This contradicts Secretary of Agriculture Ann Veneman's assertion that the infected bovine was a downer cow, meaning it couldn't walk. The USDA primarily targets such cows in its tests for the disease. Last year, the government tested about 20,000 head of cattle, 80% of which were labeled as downers. Without finding any more cases, the USDA ended its probe for related cases on February 9th. However, this week, three witnesses who worked at the same dairy farm in Washington where the disease appeared are now saying the infected animal was standing and walking before it was killed, putting doubt that it was a downer cow. One of the witnesses said he came forward because he was disappointed and frustrated over the USDA's response to the disease. This spurred the leaders of the House Committee on Government Reform, Republican Tom Davis of Virginia and Democrat Henry Waxman of California, to call on the USDA to not just reopen its probe, but to substantially test more of them, including the healthy-looking ones. Representative Waxman says just testing downers is too narrow to assess whether the disease has spread to other animals.
Their credibility is at stake. They have maintained that they are protecting the public sufficiently by only testing the downer cows. If this cow was not a downer cow, and it appears it wasn't, then their whole premise for testing is under challenge, and the public is not going to be protected unless they go beyond that small category and start random samples of what appear to be normal cows.
The agriculture and meat industries are very powerful, both economically and politically. Do you think economics has driven the USDA to test so few cows?
I do believe that to some extent, the economics, as the industry sees it from a short-term perspective, is discouraging the USDA from broader samples. In other countries, they're sampling non-downer cows. And in Japan, for example, they're, I think, testing almost every cow. I don't think we can get by on the cheap. What we've got to do is whatever is necessary to give confidence to people that they're being protected from a disease that could be fatal.
That was Representative Henry Waxman of California, the ranking Democrat on the House Committee on Government Reform, that is urging the USDA to reopen its probe for mad cow disease. The USDA did not respond to calls for comment by airtime, but in published reports, the USDA has responded by saying it still believes the Washington cow was a downer, and it says that it has the documentation to support the claim. The committee has set a March 2nd deadline for the USDA to provide such evidence. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington.
In a landmark lawsuit filed Friday, 14-year veteran assistant U.S. attorney Richard Convertino is suing his boss, John Ashcroft, and the Justice Department, accusing it of interference, mismanagement, and compromising a confidential informant. The lawsuit is being described as the latest blow to the one-time showcase terrorism trial, now on the verge of falling apart, of an alleged sleeper cell. Stephen Cohen is with the Whistleblowers Center and is the lead attorney representing Convertino. We spoke to Cohen this morning on WBAI's Wake Up Call. It seems like it's a fairly unusual step to actually sue the Justice Department. What's their response been?
Well, they haven't said anything at this time, but what's happened in the last couple of years is that the Ashcroft Justice Department has put a gag order on every Justice Department employee. They have told them they cannot blow the whistle, and specifically, they cannot go to Congress and raise complaints. That's a violation of both the Constitution, the First Amendment, and a specific whistleblower law that allows federal employees to go to Congress. What's unusual is that it's taken this long for someone in the Justice Department to finally stand up and say, you know, we have rights, we can go to our elected representative and raise issues, and we will attempt to enforce those rights in court. And that's the step that's happening now.
So when you actually sue the Justice Department, how does that process go? Does the case get put on hold while this trial goes ahead?
No. Mr. Convertino was removed from the Detroit case within a day or two after they learned he had contacted the Senate. So he's off that case. That case will go on its own.
Wrap up for us where the possibility of this case could go. You've just filed suit against the Justice Department. What are the next steps? What will we see in the next few weeks or months?
Well, we're before Judge Lamberth in Washington, D.C., and we assume the Justice Department will file motions to try to dismiss the case. He has an extremely strong Privacy Act claim. They did leak information. The constitutional claim, I think, is also very strong. So I think we'll survive those motions, and then we're looking to set some precedent here for employees' rights to at least contact Congress with allegations of misconduct.
Stephen Cohen, thank you so much for joining us. Stephen Cohen is with the National Whistleblower Center. He's the attorney representing the plaintiff in this case. With the issue of rising layoffs and outsourcing of previously domestic-based jobs to other countries dominating the Democratic presidential primary campaigns, Democratic frontrunner John Kerry has described firms which move jobs to other countries as traitors. Washington State, meanwhile, could be the first to sign legislation to help stem the tide of exporting jobs. Two proposals before the state's House Commerce and Labor Committee would ban all state business from being sent offshore and mandate that employers notify employees before compelling them to train foreign replacements. Offshore outsourcing, the practice of sending information technology and other traditionally white-collar service jobs overseas, has contributed to an implosion of the state's technology-based labour market. The state has lost as many as 10,000 jobs since 2001. Last year, Gartner Incorporated predicted that at least 1 in 10 technology jobs in the US would be moved offshore by the end of the year. FSRN's Martha Baskin has more.
The primary legislation would ban all state business from being sent offshore. It's a small percentage of business conducted in Washington state, but if passed into law, it would be the first of its kind in the nation.
The basic idea is that our taxpayer dollars shouldn't be used to create jobs someplace else. They should be used to create jobs here.
Representative Zach Hutchins, co-sponsor of the legislation and former contractor at Microsoft and employee at Amazon.com.
The state can act as a customer when it goes out and buys services, and it can demand that the services are done at a good value. So that means that not only is it the cheapest price, but also that we're creating good communities, good job base, protecting our tax base.
The Washington Alliance of Technology Workers, or WashTech, a project of the Communication Workers of America, as well as state unions and SPEA, the Society of Professional Engineering Employees in Aerospace, have lobbied hard for the legislation. Estimates by WashTech and SPEA indicate the state has lost as many as 30,000 technology-related jobs since 2001. WashTech organizer Marcus Curtney.
What's given us momentum is the fact that in Washington state, the high-tech industry only created 200 jobs between December 2002 and December 2003. And increasingly, that's because the leading companies in the state are beginning to export jobs instead of products.
The state's correction department recently extended a $25.6 million coding contract to IBM Global Services to replace its aging offender-based tracking systems. IBM then sent the job to India. IBM has stepped up efforts to replace thousands of engineering, software development, and other highly skilled U.S. jobs with counterparts in countries such as China and India. A companion piece of state legislation would mandate that employers give employees 10 days' notice before employees are ordered to engage in knowledge transfer, training a foreign replacement worker, something employees are often required to do if they want to collect benefits. Thomas Lynch, IBM's employee relations director, made reference to the practice during an internal summit leaked last year.
U.S. workers are, or workers in the country where the work is being relocated from, will in many cases be asked to train their replacements. If we're moving work to China, the Chinese management team, maybe some of the Chinese workers, will have to come to effect the transfer of knowledge needed to do that. That's going to raise a lot of tensions as you're training someone to do a job that you know is no longer going to be yours at the end of some fixed period of time.
Myra Bronstein, a quality assurance electronics engineer for Watchmark Comintel, a manufacturer of wireless management software, was asked to do just that. Bronstein testified before the Washington State Legislature.
In addition to the trauma of being outsourced and laid off, which is in itself quite devastating, then there's this layer of, oh, by the way, you have to do this demeaning, humiliating exercise, you know, in order to get severance.
The experience committed Bronstein to speaking out on behalf of other workers.
This is terrible publicity. So their solution is to abuse workers in secrecy. And I want to lift the shroud of secrecy. I want to turn the light on.
The legislation faces an uphill battle in the state, despite the fact that it's impossible for local businesses to compete with corporations who are allowed to subcontract for substandard wages. The Indian workers who now perform Myra Bronstein's work are paid an estimated $4,000 to $5,000 annually. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin reporting.
Following last week's announcement by Colombian President Uribe that his hardline regime is both democratic and popular, and that he's improving his country's appalling human rights record, the British ambassador in Bogotá insisted that there has been a vast improvement in human rights in Colombia and that the Blair government is one of Uribe's staunch supporters. But this optimistic assessment is fiercely contested in Colombia by human rights groups and members of Colombia's battered civil society. One issue cited is the government practice of mass detentions for the past 16 months as part of its security strategy to crush the country's 40-year-old insurgency groups. Police and security forces are rounding up and detaining thousands of campesinos and people in provincial towns who are being pinned as rebel supporters, or, in the words of President Uribe, terrorists. According to Colombia's defense ministry, security forces arrested nearly 7,000 suspected leftist rebels in mass roundups in 2003, an 85% increase from the year before. However, it was not clear how many of those charged were later released for lack of evidence. Nicole Carson has more from Bogota.
More than 300 soldiers, police and state agents swarmed into the jungle town of Cartagena de Chaira in Colombia's southern department of Caquetá on September 7th last year. According to some of those detained in the sweep that day, the agents told villagers to promptly go to the market for an important meeting. Manuel Moreno, a resident in Cartagena de Chaira, remembers that day.
En la casa donde yo vivo.
I was in my house with my wife and kids. They came and they took us out of the house and searched. They immediately handcuffed me and searched the house, but didn't find anything. And they took us away. They took us to the market where everyone was being held. They put us in lines. There were seven hooded men pointing people out to the authorities.
Moreno and his wife were detained in this roundup along with 81 other villagers. They were all blindfolded, handcuffed or tied, and taken to a military base where after more than the legal limit of 72 hours, they were interrogated, then flown to the capital, where they were imprisoned. Moreno explains how when the lawyers began to investigate, there was no proof against him.
So after 3 months and 19 days, I was able to leave jail. But the legal process against me is still open. My wife remains in prison.
Pastor.
Now, 6 months after the roundup in Chaira, 34 villagers are still imprisoned, while the other 45 were released after 3 to 4 months for lack of evidence. But this is only one example of this trend of arrest operations that has swept over Colombia. The Uribe administration defends it as a useful tactic in the fight against terrorism. Activists in several rural Colombian communities have declared their refusal to recognize Colombia's judicial system. The coalition of farmers, teachers, and human rights advocates say they will not cooperate with authorities conducting investigations of such suspects. Luis Eduardo Guerra is a community leader in northwestern Colombia who says that instead of assassinating community leaders, a common tactic in the past, the government is now jailing them as rebel collaborators.
It's a tragedy to tell the world that justice in Colombia is working in the service of a military and paramilitary strategy, and that the communities have to defend themselves against this, and a way of doing this is to delegitimize this justice. That's why we made a rupture with the justice system.
Daniel Garcia Peña, a former government peace commissioner, gives his take on the situation of arbitrary detentions.
Unfortunately, the current government of President Uribe has passed through a series of constitutional reforms, which has broadened the powers of the government to detain people, to arrest them without due process. This, unfortunately, I think is part of an international current. Similar things are being done in the United States under the Patriot Act and what we are seeing in Guantanamo.
Despite opposition from rights groups and the United Nations, in December, Colombia's Senate approved an anti-terrorism bill that gives the military sweeping powers to search homes, detain suspects without warrants, and wiretap phones. From Bogota, I'm Nicole Carson for Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.